Good morning. Welcome to our 10:30 technical session. We have a few technical announcements to precede the technical session. So let me go through these very quickly. We have a cast of clowns over here. So this is going to be a fun session. Tonight, there is an open session of the technical committee. And what that means is it's a chance to have a dialogue with members of the technical committee. So there'll be significant time, probably about the entire time, devoted to questions and answers. So if there are issues, well, technical issues, within your own work or your own archive that you want to explore and take advantage of the resources of this committee, you can do that this evening. And I think we start at 7:30. It's on the schedule. And also, there's been one change in terms of technical presentations. Because of a cancellation, we have a new presentation tomorrow. Mark Hood, who is the Sound Directions project engineer, is going to present on Sound Directions research into reverse playback. So if you're interested in that topic, it's going to be the last thing of the day tomorrow. And it's part of the archives and users session, I believe. Well, today we have a session that I've been looking forward to. We're going to start with a presentation on multi-track preservation of audio, which is a problem that, for me, sounds, you know, quite a bit more challenging than the kinds of things that I deal with. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing what Toby has to say about that. Following that, we're going to have a contest between man and machine, and may the best entity win. That will be George Blood. And then following that, I think Rob will smooth everything over with a presentation on audio preservation workflow, particularly how to achieve an efficient workflow, so get our heart rates back down after the presentation on man versus machine. So we'll start with Toby C., who's the assistant professor in the music industry program at Drexel University. As an engineer, he's worked on multiple gold and platinum recordings, as well as 8 Grammy winners. Toby's the director of... I've got a pop-up that's blocking my view here. It says, new software is available from Apple. I don't want new software from Apple at the moment. As I was saying, Toby is the director of the Drexel University Audio Archives. Let's please make him welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be back. It's good to be in a city with such a deep musical heritage, especially one that influences a lot of other cities' musical heritage, which certainly includes Philadelphia. Today I want to talk about a couple things. I want to outline how we got the collection that we have, how I ended up building this facility that we have, and from that, using the sources that we have and some of the thoughts that I have as far as what that can be best used for. As he mentioned, my previous career was as a recording engineer. And so I'm kind of a multi-track fan. I really dig that. So I'm really drawn to this collection for that reason. First off, a little background. I covered a little bit of this yesterday, but I'll cover a little bit more today. Sigma Sound Studios in Philadelphia was the premier recording facility in Philadelphia. Started by Joe Tarja he built it in 1967, pretty much went into full force use in 1968. Ceased productions in the early 2000s. The tape vault, the tape collection, was then transferred possession to Drexel University for preserving and upkeep. And hopefully research. The reason for that is that we have a music industry program that involves both business and law aspects of the music industry and recording production, which is, of course, where I teach. This was the site of the Sound of Philly, Gamble and Huff Records produced here. Much of what you think of as soul music out of the Philadelphia area, originated from this facility. And part of the sound that happened there was the house musicians that were used, MFSB being the house band, which was a large collection of musicians. It wasn't always the same people, but certainly had a signature sound to it. With the musicians that recorded here and the collection that we received, here are a number of the names of which are represented. Now, I don't have a comprehensive collection from this studio's output. Obviously, many record labels and many producers have their masters. But what I do have is quite substantial that we have these artists represented. The top three there, Patti LaBelle, Grover Washington Jr., and Teddy Pendergrass, are the overwhelming bulk of the collection. But we do have all these other artists represented. Talked about David Bowie yesterday. Melba Moore, Jackie Moore. You can see how this transitions into from soul into what a lot of us would refer to as disco. Here's some more. Intertwined in this are a lot of recordings that did not necessarily originate at Sigma, but came to Sigma for mixing or finishing. Many others is the key here. And there is still stuff to be yet determined its significance. A lot of research involved here. Here's what came. You can see in the analog formats that the bulk of the collection actually is stereo, whether it be and mono, quarter inch and half inch. But because most of the masters that got produced and made into albums that you can go out and buy now went to mastering, they're not here. So a lot of the stereo material that I have are external or alternate mixes, television mixes, TV tracks, a cappella versions, those kind of things. Don't have a lot of master stereo or mono mixes unless they are safety. The digital material here, I'm pleased that there's not a lot of it. And I'm also pleased that of the bulk of DAT that is here, most of these are just clones of the stereo quarter inch and half inch that are up there. So luckily I don't have to put a lot of that on a priority list. What I'm excited about is the top four. Half inch four, the one inch eight, the two inch 16, and 24 track. Because these are mostly masters. So, in order to deal with these, there had to be a lot of commitment on the university's part. Bringing it into the music industry program made sense. We have a body of students interested in studying record production. And when we get to copyright, we have a body of students interested in business and law aspects of the music industry. So there's a lot of research that can be done there. So it was a natural fit, other than the fact that we got it, put it in a room, and it sat there with no real plan of action. When I got there, I kind of drooled when I saw the room and tried to put into action some way to make this a viable research facility. The first big commitment was having a facility to house it. Now, 1,000 square foot doesn't sound very big, but in an urban campus, where I, on a monthly basis, run into a provost searching around, trying to figure out what closet they can turn into a faculty office, 1,000 square foot is a big commitment. Now, the building looks impressive, but of course, I'm in the basement. About a block and a half away from the Schuylkill River, so that's not a great thing. We do have everything's housed. We have self-contained climate control. We do our best to keep the humidity as low as we possibly can. Everything's stored properly on shelves. And for conservation, we bought an incubator in order to do some tape baking. The good news is there is very little in this collection that needs this type of processing. So far, most everything is in pretty stable condition, except when we get into some of the ampex of these late 70s and 80s. Luckily, most of the productions in Sigma stayed on scotch, and a lot of that is in pretty good shape. Very lucky with that so far. This all, by the way, I should mention, the provost office gave us a grant to build this facility. Wasn't a huge grant, so a lot of prioritization had to go into place of what to buy and how to do it. Now, one of the things I fit into the budget was consulting, and I found that this ended up being really, really important. I come from the audio world, not the library world, and I kind of needed help. And so we were able to fit into the budget. BMS Chase provided us with a customized database that we're still tweaking, and automated tools to deal with the file sets that we end up with once we digitize. This has been very fruitful. BMS Chase came into play mainly because I'm a Nashville engineer, and I already had an association with, and that were the first people that I went to. And that has been incredibly valuable. It would have been really easy to spend all my money on equipment. So pulling back money for this type of thing was kind of uncomfortable, but boy, I'm glad I did. We're also lucky in the fact that ATR Services is about an hour and a half drive from Philadelphia. So we were able to work out a deal where I could commission buying machines and not have to ship them from anywhere. So with the formats that I have, a Studer 827 with three head stacks are able to do 24, 16, and 8-track. And an ATR 102 able to do the half and quarter. We were able to get an Atari MTR 12 from a local video facility that has been refurbished and is in pretty good shape. Luckily, there's not a lot of that, but that works pretty well. And in the early incarnation of the music industry program, when they built the initial recording studios, whoever designed them decided to put DAT machines in all the studios, which have had 0 hours. They've never been used. So now I have a couple of those laying around to deal with if needed. The hardest part was that most of the Sigma Sound collection is encoded with Dolby A. So that goes from every analog format there is, from mono all the way up to 24-track. So we had to find Dolby A, and that was difficult. Basically had to buy a lot of Dolby A to get 24 channels in good working order. But luckily, I had ATR Services. It basically took them a year to find the machines and go through them to make sure they were in as good a working order as possible. And we also got Dolby SR just in case. So far, I think I found one reel of tape with Dolby SR. But
doesn't SR have a switch where you can make a Dolby?
Depends on the rack that you buy. It ended up being, in order to find what we needed to find, cost-effective to get just two separate racks. In order to fit into my budget, most cost-effective, good-sounding conversion for digitization that I could find was at 32 ins and outs of Apogee Symphony. Using Cubase Studio 5 as a front end. We had problems with Logic. We started with Logic because it's very cheap for educators, but the broadcast WAV file was just not usable. It doesn't really create a real one, so we went and threw that away and started over with Cubase Studio 5. And for paper materials, large format scanner in order to scan boxes. Slow process, but it is very useful. File storage, I could not afford this. And so it wasn't in the original plan. The original plan was LTO4 only for long-term storage. But a vendor for at Drexel LSI Corporation, with a little prodding, came up with a Sun Storage Tech 2500 they were able to donate to the archive. This was significant. Unfortunately, I can't really fill this much storage up at this point. I really have to have a lot of throughput to do this. But it's a nice gift to have. I'm hoping I'm able to use it to its full capacity before, you know, it's all obsolete and all the drives die. But it is a very nice gift to have. So with all of that, that was $90,000. That's hard to do. I felt we did pretty well, considering that was our starting point. But with that starting point, we're now able to use it, finally. And so just a little overview of the music industry program. These are a picture of two of our facilities. We have 5 recording studios on campus, 2 of them with SSL 4000, G pluses, and then a number of other smaller facilities. We have a student population in our program right around 200. About half of that are technology oriented, and our facilities are used a lot for extracurricular activity, not just curricular activity. So our students get a lot of hands-on work. Now, some of the things, I want to show you a few things from the multi-track collection and kind of show you what kind of excites me to go in every day and show you how valuable this is, not only to our undergrad music industry students, but what could be very useful for outside researchers in musicology as well. I'm going to show a number of these. I'm going to go from 4-track to 8-track, 16-track to 24-track. With a couple of audio snippets. But here is a 4-track from 1968. Artist Charlie Fegan, Philly Groove Records, producer Stan Watson. And this is a typical 4-track that you would find in our collection and how it's kind of laid out. This is the track sheet as well as the take sheet. Tracks 1, 2, 3, and 4. Drums and bass, they share a track. Organ and guitar, they share a track. Horns are by themselves, and the lead are by themselves. So this isn't incredibly complicated. There's no background vocals here. There's no piano or strings. You can almost point to, is that because of the constraints of some of the technology, or was that just how this lays out? What I'm going to show you in the next slide is going to be bringing in each of these tracks one by one until they all combine at the end. What this shows, and a lot of our students who are living in a Pro Tools world are shocked by, is the drums on a single track with effects, and the bass is in there too. There's a lot that's here that had to be decided on. Mixer, by the way, JT, that's Joe Tarja. He's the he was the owner, and he built the studio. And when you listen back to anything with JT written on it, it's really well done. So here is this 4-track and how it lays together.
Keep on loving me, yeah.
four tracks. Not sure to this day who Charlie Fegan is. I have not found this release anywhere noted. Maybe some of you can help me on that front. We move up 1 year, 1969. We have Grover Mitchell, who was a Georgia artist. This was kind of towards the end of his career. His career mainly was in the late 50s and early 60s. Soul singer from Georgia, Johnny Madara. Again, JT is the engineer here. Brought him to Philly to do a record for United Artists. Now we see things start to spread out a little bit. Bass has its own track. The drums and conga are together. We have guitar, a single guitar part on a track. But we also have track five there, which has vibes, guitar, and piano all combined. Nice balance together with effects accordingly. Now we have strings on a track and horns on a track and a lead vocal on track seven. What they forgot to write down is track six, which is the background vocals, but they are there. 11 takes. Obviously, with at this time is also going for performance. There's lots of leakage between instruments. You can kind of hear on track to track. Only a couple of complete takes. This is take 11, which turned out to be the only one that had a lead vocal put on it. Yes? Complete take. Complete take.
Like on the previous thing, it said CT track six, but there's only four tracks.
Right. Some of this you kind of have to figure out once you get it on and start listening back to what they actually meant, because not all the notes are right. Yes?
Okay, you said there was leakage between instruments on tracks. Does that imply that this was recorded live?
Yes. Okay. For the most part. The lead vocal was overdubbed on this case. But a lot of this was recorded live. What a lot of times you'll see with these 11 takes, like that guitar, the vibes, guitar, and piano are all combined, but they originally weren't. This is the end result. But so on tracks 1 through 10, the one that wasn't the one that they used for the record, you may find a completely different track arrangement as they recorded it, and then things got bounced together later. So you kind of have to do some sleuthing to figure out what that is, because the track sheet will pretty much only list what it is for the master take. So here's Mr. Teardrops by Grover Mitchell and how it lays together. Sounding for only eight tracks, which is shocking to a lot of our students, but very well done. Since we're in New Orleans, I found this tape in the collection. I don't know if any of you went to see her the other night at Lafayette Park, Irma Thomas. This was unreleased. She had a brief stint on Atlantic Records. It wasn't something I think she's very fond of. I think one single got released from this time period. These are two tracks that were done by the production team of Sigler and Hurt in Philly in hopes to... They were kind of searching, I think. They've done it. They did a number of things. Her quote, I believe, is, "They kept trying to make me sound like Diana Ross. That's not me, so it just didn't work." But anyway, what we have here is... Now we start seeing things really spread out to what we're starting to see, you know, what we're used to in modern times. Bass on a track. Now the drums are spread over three separate tracks. Bass drum, the snare and overheads together, toms. Three guitar parts, all on their own tracks. Mono piano, mono organ, marimbas, conga, all separated out, lead vocal. even the horns are started to be separated out. We have the trumpets on a track, the bones and the buried are together, the backgrounds, and then the doubled strings. So this was a bounce, obviously. They did two tracks of strings, then bounced them down to one to get the double. This is a track called No Name. This kind of goes, since there's 16 tracks, it kind of flips through kind of quick, so it might be a little hard to keep track of. But here is No Name by Irma Thomas. So again, track count's bigger, things are spread out, things are starting to become more complicated, there's a lot more room to do things. Now for a famous one that we all have heard, Whitehead and McFadden's hit, Ain't No Stopping Us Now. Now we have 24 tracks, and now we start to see things change. Not so much in the production value, but how they're recorded. We now have things in stereo. The strings, doubles are remaining on two tracks. The trumpets and bones and barrier spread across three, which now allows for a broader stereo spread. The drums are now spread over five tracks. We have the bass drum, the snare, the hi-hat, and the combined toms and overheads as a stereo track. We have so many tracks that track 7 and track 22 are automation data. So those aren't even musical. And we have two lead vocals, lots of overdubs, stereo background vocals. Big production, 1978. And all of those are just, those are faders pulled up. That's not, you know, nothing much grander than a than that. No processing done for what you just heard. That's just what all the, obviously the records were then processed more with, you know, time-based effects and whatnot when they mixed this record. But you can see how things have really changed sonically, production-wise. And it allows you to kind of go in and microscope if you really wanted to listen in solo to each individual instrument. Not that listening to an individual kick drum mic isn't going to be all that intriguing, but this drums as a set and the drums as it works with other instruments. So here is why the multi-track intrigues me. From a musicological perspective, being able to study popular music arrangements by being able to dissect it. Yes, we can hear what's on the record, but for instance, that last track, Ain't No Stopping Us Now, you listen to the album, it's very different than what is actually on the tape because there was decisions being made in the mix process. The first time you hear the background vocals, is not where the first time the background vocals come in on the multitrack. So you can see how those decisions were being made as they were producing the record. Arrangements as they relate to the technology, when you have track constraints, decisions have to be made. Today, to think about the decision on whether to do something in a mono fashion or a stereo fashion is merely an aesthetic. But it really didn't, you didn't have the freedom to do a lot of stereo back at that time when you had limited track counts. And, you know, with arrangements specific to geographical regions, I had a researcher who spent a lot of time in the Motown vault looking at the multitracks. Came into our facility, and in about 10 minutes, it's like, this is so differently done. The way they laid out the tracks, the way they went about creating the albums, strictly just being in a different city, different influences. So those, from a musicological standpoint, I find are very intriguing for research purposes. On the music production side, this gives our students and other students a way to look at, you know, balancing of instruments. They can listen to a mix, and they can look at the multitrack. You know, when you're creating a multitrack, you're recording those tracks to maximize signal-to-noise ratio. It has no bearing on how loud that instrument's going to be in the final mix. This gives students an opportunity to compare and see, here's how it was recorded, here was the end result when the mix. Not to mention, when you look at some of those limited track counts, like 4 and 8 track, you have to combine it on tape. You have to make that decision even before you mix the record, and seeing how that was done and applying those time-based effects at the time. Track processing, speaking of those time-based effects, when you're on 4 tracks and you have to combine the guitar and the piano and the vibes, and there's a specific reverb you want to put on the guitar, you have to do it when you combine it, because you can't put it on later because you're also going to apply it to the vibes and the piano. So knowing that ahead of time makes a big difference. Students are oftentimes shocked when they hear a lead vocal on a multi-track that has delay already on it. You get to 24 tracks, everything's still separate, we can do that later. So it's a much drier scenario. And so that's how the processing relates to the actual technology. So with that in mind, I also have to state that us taking this collection made sense for us. We had a built-in climate. It may not make sense for everyone. Multitrack is not something that every institution is going to be able to have the means or the population to look at it. However, I have in the back of my head the thought that more institutions maybe should look at this if they do have the possibility and they do have a built-in audience. Studios are dying left and right, and tape collections are disappearing as there's no place to put them. So an educational institution may be the right fit, as long as you can kind of answer the questions. Do we have a research audience, and can we commit the resources by which are needed to actually use that resource? And that's all for me today. Any questions? Yes?
How are they keeping tones on their masters? Are there any tones on these tapes?
Well, if it's 4-track and 8-track, there are no tones. So my approach has been MRL it, make it flat, as possible, and then look at what comes back to see what the level, the overall level would have been. When it comes to 16 and 24, Sigma had the habit, and it's a good habit, but it's sometimes annoying. They printed tones on every reel of tape. If the project had 9 reels of 2-inch, every reel had tones on it. 12 seconds of tones. But at least there's a tone, which is good, because when there's missing pieces, you can always get it back. They sometimes skimped and only put Dolby tone and 10K. But but that can still get you pretty far. But yeah, luckily in most cases, especially with 16 and 24, there are tones.
So how did you handle if this tape didn't have tone? What kind of decision would you make in reference to Dolby?
Luckily, 4 and 8 in this collection have no Dolby. They bought Dolby when they bought 16 track. So that's when they started printing tones. Yes?
Talk about the automated boards and the problems you may have had with that.
Well, the automation says, now this was something about Sigma Sound Studios, is they jumped on technology quickly, though they didn't change from Dolby A to SR, but they jumped on 16 track really soon. They jumped on 24 track really soon. They were also one of the very first studios in the entire country that had an automated mixing desk. Basically, when you're mixing, you can record your fader moves, and it'll play them back. Therefore, you don't have to be the five-armed engineer. You can spend time, record vocal rides, it'll play it back. Now you can work on something else. Their early automation system, where you saw on the Ain't No Stopping Us Now track, recorded the data onto a track on tape. Then when you got done with a pass, you patched that data back into the console's computer to play back what you did and record your next pass on another track of tape. And then when you got done with that pass, you changed the patches. And so you used two tracks and you kept swapping the data. Eventually, they were able to tie this to SMPTE. So all you had to do was have time code on a track. The console could chase that, and all the data got stored in the computer rather than on data on the tape. But prior to really good computers, you would have to do it that way. The automation, the problem with that is if I really wanted to recall one of these mixes, I would have to have that console with that automation system.
But did you digitize?
I digitized the automation. The other thing is the paper that is in the tape boxes, track sheets and whatnot, you really have to pay attention to, because there are times when they decided we're not going to use Dolby on that track. So you really have to read it ahead of time when you're digitizing it. Oftentimes they would not print Dolby on the drum tracks. And of course they wouldn't print Dolby on data tracks, because that would be very, very strange.
Yes. In some cases, I went through this, there were boxes full of first 8-inch and then 5.5-inch floppy disks.
Yes.
And I assumed that those were for an automated board that no longer was either set up the same way or no longer existed.
Correct. There are a lot of automation disks in the collection. At first I was kind of happy to see, oh, 2-inch reel, 2-inch reel. Uh-oh, a 1-inch reel. Is that a Prodigy? And I open it up and it's a bunch of floppies. It's like, but then I ended up finding Prodigy reels. But those floppies, of course, were the stored automation data for the mixdown. Again, doesn't do me a lot of good without that automation system on that particular console. There are a lot of recall sheets in here, too, where the console was mapped out with EQ settings, and that's very fascinating for students to look at. Especially since some of it's API, and we can just go to a lab and grab an API EQ and somewhat replicate some of that. Yes?
Were you able to track down music production techniques? I mean, since you were saying that Sigma jumped on the technologies as they evolved fairly quickly, for example, I was curious to see when they did stereo overheads.
Right. Right.
How soon that was 1970?
Irma Thomas was 70. That was a mono overhead. That was 1972.
So
by 73, they started doing stereo overheads. I started finding stereo.
And how did that respond to, let's say, the rest of the planet or the U.S.? Were they leading edge in that regard? Or was that just that particular production happened to be in 72, but in fact people were doing it in 70?
I can't speak to that. That would certainly be a great thing for a musicologist to research. I can only speak to this collection, and we're lucky in the fact that most of these people are still alive.
Right.
And we can reach out and get a lot of information from them. Most of the ones I've talked to don't really, they did stereo because it was kind of then the thing to do, but most of them were like, you know, what's stereo about a drum overhead? It's just a loud thing, you know. It's like, so that's what I get from a lot of them, but yeah, that would be an interesting study. Yes?
Do you have a plan in place to digitize this entire collection in an organized fashion, or are you picking and choosing what you most?
Currently, I'm picking and choosing, and the reason for that is to kind of discover what is there. And luckily, since most of it does not need any sort of baking or processing, because I don't want to like pull stuff out and bake it just to see what's there. So luckily, I can just put up a reel of tape, see what it is. My initial rolling tape was I want to play back every format I have to make sure all the systems work. And with that, I now have, you know, that's where I am. We don't have a huge digitization plan because it is stable. It's no real huge rush. But yeah, we're trying to find funding to do that.
Last question.
What about cataloging?
Yes. Cataloging is done basically like this. We have the database that we've built with BMS. And I have library and information science grad students doing the initial descriptions, you know, the barcoding, the name of the art, just the really basic stuff to describe what is that object. When I then look at and say, okay, I've got that initial data, when I do the transfer or the scannings of the box labels, then I start adding all the other information afterwards. Track sheets, artists, producers. It's a huge amount of information, and it takes forever. Training students at this point to start to be able to do some of that. But it does take, obviously, going to the tapes and the files, and is what it says what's really there. But yeah, it's a long, slow process. We did the math on how to process all this, and at the current rate, it was even with only 6,100 objects, you know, we were looking at, if we were going to digitize and catalog everything to its fullest, we were looking at about 12 years at the current rate. We're going to speed that up, obviously, now, but we're getting that rolling. Our workflow is not perfect yet. We're getting there. Is that?
Well, so, there's a lot more to ask.
Yeah,
Where you keep it, how you interact, you know, how you archive.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's another presentation.
Yeah.
Thank you, Toby.
Thanks.